Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, you're listening to the Politics Without the Boring Bits podcast. I'm Patrick Maguire, and today I'm going to take you on a journey back to 2010. David Cameron's about to become Prime Minister. He's got lofty ideas about the big society, but over there is George Osborne demanding cuts to public spending. Will he be able to implement this bold and radical agenda? And what can Keir Starmer learn from their experience? That's what we're talking about on the podcast today, after I hear from two fantastic columnists. Here's Manveen Rana and Matt Fry.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Yes, as ever, on a Thursday, we're joined by Manveen Rana, host of the Story podcast. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
And, as is customary, someone called Matthew. Although, don't mention it, he's actually not called Matthew, but it'll do. Matt Fry from Channel 4 News. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Patrick.
Great to be joined by you both. Let's start off with the situation in Israel. I was just talking to Sir Alan Duncan, the former Deputy Foreign Secretary, about this. Rishi Sunak is obviously going to have to make a call one way or the other on whether the UK will continue to sell arms to Israel. Three former Supreme Court judges are among hundreds of legal experts who warn it breaches international law due to Israel's conduct. Several Conservative MPs, the SNP and the Liberal Democrats have all said the supply must stop right now. But Tory MP Bob Seeley, who's a former soldier and a member of the Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee, doesn't agree.
Turkey, Israel, Saudi, they all operate in areas of the world where there is a significant terrorist threat to this country. And if we start saying, well, we're not going to intelligence share with you, or we're not going to sell you arms, and then they break off their relationships with us, then when we want information to keep Britain safe, it's not going to be forthcoming. And then the same people are saying, why, oh, why don't you do something, will be saying, why, oh, why did you do this?
Okay.
So I just think we have to put, frankly, our national interest in an increasingly dangerous world first.
And just a moment ago, Sir Alan Duncan told me why he thought the sale of arms to Israel could no longer be justified.
I have called for a suspension of arms sales. I mean, I think it's impossible now for any of the Foreign Office lawyers to justify continuing sales to Israel. There are clearly, obvious breaches in the rules governing this. So, yes, sales should stop. We don't sell that much, but it's very important that if we've set the rules for ourselves, we should adhere to them. And that's why I think it would be very difficult for any Foreign Office lawyer to feel comfortable giving advice to the Foreign Secretary that actually these sales can continue.
Manveen, it's been 6 months now since the attack, nearly 6 months since the attack on Israel on October the 7th. That was a time of unanimous Western support, understandably, for Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. We're watching the international position shift quite significantly this week. It's really interesting to consider how we got here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been coming for a while.
A lot of the governments are now starting to voice what we've sort of seen, you know, looking at polling and looking at sort of many of the protests taking place across Western countries. We've sort of seen public opinion shift an awful lot. And I think, you know, it's a number of factors. It's the sheer level of deaths of civilians, which, you know, it's unprecedented in recent conflicts. There's the obvious sort of disregard, really, for humanitarian calls for international law, you know, the sort of flattening of hospitals, the cutting off of water and food supplies, all of the things that, you know, an occupying force is supposed to be liable for, getting aid into a country, not happening. It's very hard to watch the footage that is coming out of Gaza and not feel appalled by what's going on. Israel hasn't helped itself in a way by having, you know, there are members of the government now who actually have very little support in the country, but because it's a coalition, you know, people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir who are coming out saying the most outrageous things, you know, talking about sort of shifting all the Palestinians from Gaza altogether, resettling them in other countries, in Africa, you know, which just feeds into the idea that this is turning from an attack on terror to an, you know, effectively ethnic cleansing. I think it's very hard for Israel's allies to stand by and see people in the cabinet saying things like that and still be, you know, completely supportive. And I think also it's very interesting, if you look across sort of America and Britain, there's a generational thing happening too, which I think governments are sort of catching up to. So we've sort of seen a lot of younger people who are either watching footage on TikTok, who are sort of turning, you know, becoming much more sort of pro-Palestinian as a result of this. But also I think it's sort of like there's a historic thing where, you know, when I covered the region for a while and I talked to sort of some of the older correspondents, and there was a real sort of sense that, you know, people used to go to Israel on kibbutzes as sort of like, you know, the liberal thing to do, you know, off to university. And there was a real sort of sense of supporting Israel as this sort of, you know, this plucky nation. And I think it's sort of, you know, proximity to the Second World War. People who sort of still remember that period, you know, there's a sense of guilt that comes with it. Whereas I think, you know, for my generation, it was interesting. You grew up kind of assuming, and I worry a bit that this is changing, but, you know, assuming anti-Semitism was just, you know, that was never, never.
That had been put to bed.
I mean, that had been put to bed. Yeah. That's mad. And it was much more about the values you got from the Second World War, which is that you must never dehumanize people. You must never sort of, you know, you must never kill people in you know, slaughter people by in masses just for who they are, just for their ethnicity. And so it's very hard to watch what's happening now and not see it almost as an echo of that, but just with different players. And I think that's also led to a big disparity between sort of many of the political classes and, you know, younger voters.
And the tricky thing for the political class, I guess, Matt, is that as much as they are deeply uncomfortable, evidently, both President Biden and Rishi Sunak have made this clear to Benjamin Netanyahu, the response they will get, and it's a coherent one, if an increasingly unpopular one, from Prime Minister Netanyahu, is, well, look, Hamas haven't released the hostages, and on a geopolitical level, do you really want to pull support from me and effectively end up siding with the Iranians, Hamas, Hezbollah? So there's, you know, as well as being obviously appalled by the humanitarian situation in Gaza, our leaders are also having to deal with quite a complex geopolitical situation in a very volatile region too, aren't they?
Well, I think there are several things there, Patrick. I think there was a security consideration that the Americans are going to, which is Israel, in its very robust response to Hamas in the Gaza Strip, ultimately detrimental to its own security, in the sense that it's becoming more isolated in the region, it's upsetting, you know, people like the Saudi government. I mean, the Saudi Arabia was so close to signing a deal with Israel, which would have been the holy grail of, you know, normalization of Israel's relationship with the rest of the Middle East, Iran to one side, obviously. And obviously that was all, you know, torpedoed by the Hamas attacks. And you could argue that was one of the purposes of that attack. But for the Saudi government now to say, we will do a deal with Israel, which they still want to do, I gather, from my sources, against the wishes of their population, who are incensed by what is going on in the Gaza Strip, is very difficult. And that situation, that sort of division between the Arab street and the Arab palace, if you like, is replicated across the region. But for President Biden, there's a really interesting nuance in all this. It used to be the kind of cliche of American politics, especially in a presidential election year, that if you upset the, you know, the Jewish American lobby, especially as a Democrat, you end up losing an election. But what we saw, for instance, in the primaries elections in Michigan, in the state of Michigan, where Arab Americans, which are considerable in number there, something like 250,000, many of those didn't participate in the primary election for their natural party, which is the Democrat Party, or they wrote uncommitted on the ballot. That raised the prospect for the White House that they would lose swing states like Michigan because of the Arab American vote, not going for Trump. They would never vote for Trump, but not voting at all. Or, for instance, the student vote, you know, the young vote that Mandine referred to as well earlier, in places like North Carolina, which is another swing state, but, you know, big university community, not voting for Biden. That sliver of, you know, 80,000, 100,000 votes, that's all it takes to lose the White House in 2024. So the Biden administration is caught between, on one hand, doing what it always has done, which is to support Israel and the right to defend itself, and then really embarrassed by Israel's excessive response in the Gaza Strip.
Manveen,
yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say, yeah, I was in Israel a couple of weeks ago and I interviewed Ehud Olmert, the former Israeli prime minister, while I was there. And he was really interesting. You know, he sort of said, Biden is an old friend, but I hope he listens to this. I want him to know that he won't lose Jewish votes by being tougher on Israel right now and being tougher on Netanyahu. He might even gain some because there's a huge lobby of, sort of Jewish protests against what's happening in Gaza in America at the moment.
Well, it's very easy to forget as well, as I was talking to Sir Alan Duncan earlier, that before the war, there were rolling massive protests in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities against Benjamin Netanyahu's overreach. Yeah, and that sort of criticism is very much coming back. Matt, a final thought on all of this from you.
Well, I think the point is that the administration has realized, and to some extent Downing Street, you know, tucked in right behind them, that Bibi Netanyahu is more intent on listening to the hard right wingers in his cabinet, people like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, who've said the most unspeakable things about Palestinians and especially about the Gaza Strip. He's more intent to listen to them because they keep him in power with his very slim coalition majority than he is intent on listening to the White House. And at some stage, the White House will have to make a decision about whether to, you know, stop arms shipments to Israel. They may get there. I mean, they've done that in the past once before. They may do that again. And if they do that, obviously we will do the same. But as ever with all these big matters, Downing Street waits for America to move first and then we file in behind them. I expect the same will happen this time.
Now, David Cameron is with NATO foreign ministers in Brussels today to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the alliance. They've also agreed to start planning for a greater role in coordinating military aid to Ukraine. But with the possibility of a second term for Donald Trump looming on the horizon, is the alliance future-proof and fit for purpose? Manveen, looking at the pictures from Brussels, it's sort of difficult to sort of escape the conclusion that this might be the last meeting for NATO as we know it, if Donald Trump gets in and changes the structure or indeed pulls America out.
Yeah, they're going out with a bang. to be fair to him, in his comments about it so far, Donald Trump has said that he wouldn't pull out of NATO as long as the other partners pull their weight. As little as I agree with most things that Donald Trump says, there is something in that. For years now, I think the problem with NATO has been that America has been such a big force in it, and everyone has been so dependent on America, being the main player, that actually everyone's got away with spending less and less on defence. I mean, we have spent less on defence. It's ironic. If you look at sort of defence spending in this country, it was so high in the 80s when the threat of the Cold War loomed. And now that, you know, that Cold War has heated up quite a bit and Russia really is a threat, we're spending far less now than we were back then. And that's not even taking into account inflation. We've all sort of smudged the lines a bit. So 2%, you know, we say we're meeting the 2% target of spending 2% of GDP on defence. But increasingly over the last few years, you know, that's taken in not only the pensions of soldiers, but even the pensions of civilians in the MOD. We're paying pensions for civil servants out of that defence pot. That is not going towards, you know, anything that's going to keep us safe at night should there be a war. And so I do think that the rest of Europe probably does need, you know, the rest of NATO probably does need to do a bit more. But it, I mean, it's terrifying because NATO is probably more needed now than it has been for decades there really is a genuine threat of Russia looming. You know, if you go to Poland at the moment, places like Krakow, people are selling property because they're really worried that they won't be, you know, they won't be defended if Russia turns up. And, you know, I think we're not listening enough to the Baltic states who feel the threat much more, who are, you know, they're throwing everything at defence right now. And I really worry about how all of this changes when Donald Trump comes in, well, and things get worse.
It's really interesting as well. You'd mention the lack of sort of urgency on defence spending. There's an interesting interview with John Healey, who's Labour's Shadow Defence Secretary, in this week's New Statesman, where he says, actually, he's not, you know, Labour talk a good game on defence, but he sort of, when it's put your money where your mouth is time, he said, well, I won't actually push Rachel Reeves to increase that to 2.5% of GDP. It was a very striking and quite alarming comment.
Striking because at the moment, I think public opinion wouldn't mind more being spent on defence. I think people genuinely see that the world is more insecure than it has been in years, and they want to feel like we're going to be protected, particularly if Trump gets in and there's no guarantee that America will turn up to save us.
Matt, NATO, fit for purpose?
You know, it's so funny. Absolutely fit for purpose and needs to be fit for purpose, and has found its spine again, thanks to Vladimir Putin of Russia. It's so ironic, not quite funny, but ironic, that just before the Russia invasion, it was President Emmanuel Macron of France who said that NATO is brain dead.
Brain dead, yeah.
Do you remember he said that? Yeah. And then a few months later, you know, Ukraine was invaded by Russia. NATO stepped up to the plate. Okay, Trump was a complicating factor before that because he said, you guys aren't paying enough money, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And as Mandin said, that's a fair point. And actually, I'm not sure that Trump wants to destroy NATO for his friend Vladimir Putin. I don't buy that. I think what he wants is a good deal. Because for him, it's all transactional. And if you can show to Trump that, you know, we've paid this amount of extra money and, you know, there's a deal to be done here and America is not being taken to the cleaners, when they're not being fleeced, I think he'll stay on board, frankly. Also because the arms industry in America will breathe down his neck and say, mate, we're making a lot of money here. You know, don't deprive us of these dollars. But I think the other interesting thing is that politically, and Macron is very much, you know, in charge here, in the lead, and it's so ironic considering that France didn't even want to join NATO, you know, initially. Politically, the French have realized perhaps more than anyone else that Europe needs to stand on its own feet more than it has done so far, because we don't know what's going to happen in America. So that's why he came up with this line about we may have to deploy NATO soldiers on the ground in Ukraine. That was immediately shot down by the Americans and by the Brits, but also especially by the Germans. And we're in this sort of in-between mood, aren't we, Patrick? Because on one hand, we realize that Russia is a very big threat. They've actually invaded a country. They might invade more. Every time Putin opens his mouth and gives a speech, we get cold shivers down our spine in the rest of Europe. But we're not quite ready yet to do what, you know, various, you know, British defense secretaries and former defense secretaries and generals want us to do, which is to prepare for war, to be in a pre-war state, as Grant Chaps put it. And again, Vladimir Putin could push us there with, you know, another big attack on Kyiv, or, you know, a couple of very robust and scary speeches. But at some stage in the next year, we're going to have to really make up our mind. What are we prepared to do financially and in other sacrifices in order to basically shore up not just Ukraine, but NATO? And I was in Kyiv a couple of weeks ago and interviewed Zelensky in his, you know, in his bunker, or sort of palace turned bunker, sandbags in the windows. Very impressive guy, I've got to say. I mean, he's short, but my God, is he impressive. Looks you straight in the eye, firm handshake. You know, he's a real hombre. He's a good hombre, as Trump would put it. And he said, you know, he more or less said, I don't get it with you guys. You've got a bargain here. We are sacrificing our men and our women for a cause that you fundamentally believe in, which is the cause of liberal democracy in Europe. And all you need to do is send us some weapons. And so here, the Americans especially are not sending weapons, or not as many as they should be sending. And you've got boys sitting by their artillery pieces in Donbass with nothing to put in them to fire at the Russians. So they're now looking at further strategic withdrawals in order to save both men and ammunition in the coming weeks. And that is a very sorry state for them to be in. And there will come a point when this salami slicing in the opposite direction goes so far that the Russians will feel suitably emboldened in order to go have another go at Kyiv, which I'm absolutely convinced they will do. And that will be a really bad, bad day for not just for NATO, but also obviously for Europe and what's left of the Western alliance. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing that Zelensky wants us to focus on. And then consider finally and briefly the irony that the reason why these weapons aren't coming from America to the front line in Donbass is not because of a general lack of spine in NATO or, you know, Americans have lost interest in Ukraine. It's because this is yet again part of the American presidential election cycle. Mm. Because part of the deal of handing over the weapons to Ukraine is fixing the border issues with illegal migration with Mexico. Now, they can be fixed quite easily, but the Republicans don't want to hand Joe Biden a triumph, which he can use in the election campaign. They would rather see the border go to unravel further, which they can then blame on the administration, and hang Ukraine out to dry, not because they love Vladimir Putin, but because they don't want to hand Joe Biden a domestic victory.
That was Manveen Rana and Matt Fry there. Remember, you can listen to Manveen on our sister podcast, The Story. It's one story told in depth by our expert colleagues from The Times every day. But now, fire at the quattro. It's time to go back to 2010.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Thing.
Now, I'm going to take you back now to the year 2010.
10 o'clock. And this is what we're saying. It's going to be a hung parliament with the Conservatives as the largest party.
I've informed the Queen's private secretary that it's my intention to tender my resignation to the Queen. I wish the next Prime Minister well as he makes the important choices for the future.
I aim to form a proper and full coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats.
I bring this with me everywhere, the note that the Treasury Minister left, and it's there it is. Dear Chief Secretary, I'm afraid there is no money. That is the situation I inherited.
Now, in the last 40 years, government has only changed hands twice, from Labour to the Conservatives, or the Conservatives to Labour. Prime Ministers may have come and gone, but the last time we saw a new party taking the reins of power was back in 2010, when Gordon Brown, after a week or so, moved out of Number 10 and David Cameron's coalition arrived. If it happens again this year, what can Labour learn from their last exit from power and David Cameron's transition 14 years ago? How did the Conservatives prepare? How did it work out in reality when they didn't win that majority and had to govern with the Liberal Democrats? Well, in a new report for the Future Governance Forum, Phil Tinline, political historian, author of The Death of Consensus, the Times Political Book of the Year 2022, and friend of the show, looks at exactly this, looking back on interviews with former ministers, special advisers, and permanent secretaries to trace what went well and what went less well. And Phil joins me in the studio now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. So, I guess the essay question here is, was it a successful transition to power for David Cameron in 2010?
Well, I think at the departmental level, their preparations were very impressive. They were thorough, they were detailed, they developed business plans, which they'd sort of stress-checked with the Shadow Chief Secretary, and that they'd taken into the access talks so that they'd really started to build both a relationship of some trust with civil servants, but also a clear sense of what they wanted to do, and indeed what they wanted to stop doing. I think where it worked less well, and this is Macmillan's events, Dear Boy events, is the rather large event of the crash in 2008, really upended some of their early plans, which were much more focused on what was sometimes called the big society, but sort of repairing the social fabric, as the phrase went. And as soon as the question of the deficit and deficit reduction came in, that produced a much different objective. And I think it's fair to say, and I think people who were pretty close to the operation, including Cameron himself to some extent, and so they went into that election with a rather blurred offer. And so you have this curious contrast between, at the top level, a blurred offer, a kind of contrasting objectives, but departmental level, it worked much better.
Well, let's speak to two people who were there in those days and weeks and months after the 2010 general election. Baroness Fall, Kate Fall, was Deputy Chief of Staff for David Cameron in Number 10. Hello, Kate.
Hi there.
And Sean Kemp is a former advisor to Nick Clegg, who managed the press office for the Liberal Democrats during the 2010 general election. Hi, Sean.
Hiya.
Kate, take us back then to those days, weeks and months after the 2010 election, and indeed before. What sort of work went into preparing for the first Tory government in 13 years?
So the first thing to say is that, you know, the economic situation did change the early Cameron offer, as Fulda said, from something which was more sort of socially minded to something which was very economically focused. The whole putting the finances back on the right track. And that was also the glue that bound the coalition. And Sean will talk about that himself. But that moment in the Rose Garden was not just a sort of fresh start, but it was also indicated a new way of government, because it was the first coalition for such a long time. I think Britain woke up to seeing this relationship, Nick Clegg, David Cameron, and a plan which was to put the finances back on track. So I think those were the two biggest things. And the other thing I would just say, Patrick, is there is always an issue when you're coming into an election where you're just focused on winning. Mm. And you do not want to put a lot of resources into what you do that first, you know, 24, 72 hours. But you do need a few people who are thinking about that. Otherwise, you come in and you're not ready.
Sean, obviously you were sat on the other side of the coalition. What was your sense from that perspective of the difference being in a coalition made to what the Conservatives wanted to do? Did you feel like you had meaningful influence? Did you feel like you were meaningfully changing the direction of government? Or was this really a sort of Faustian impact on the economy? Did you feel like you were sort of really driving the agenda?
Well, I think the Liberal Democrats would say we did feel that we had a pretty decent impact on the policy agenda, you know, within reason, given the fact we only had 57 seats. I mean, we used to get criticised that we hadn't had more, but it would essentially have been a coup if we'd had much more. I think, given the amount of MPs we had, we felt we did have a reasonable impact on the policy agenda. And we'd gone into the election with four key policies that were on the front of the manifesto that we wanted to deliver in case there had been a coalition. So we sort of thought that through, and we sort of got those agreed and delivered. The other element of it, as we've already touched on, was then austerity came in. So, well, not austerity came in, but we'd all reached an agreement that there had to be very significant action in terms of government spending. And almost the most important thing, as Kate said, was that kind of Rose Garden moment and the rest of it, to try and send a message on to the market. So this was going to be a stable government that was going to take spending seriously. And actually, that was the thing that straight from the start almost directed a lot of action, which is the first thing we've got to do is show we're serious about handling the economy and that this is going to be a government that's going to last. And that was the priority almost above all else. The first sort of weeks, I would say, just getting into people's heads that this is not going to be a government that's going to collapse after a month, which people were saying it would be.
And Kate, the interesting thing, or the point you raised about getting in and looking under the bonnet and thinking, as you've both said, the fiscal situation we've inherited from Gordon Brown here is much, much worse than we thought. Obviously, you can plan any number of sort of high-minded policy initiatives, any number of sort of new governing philosophies, but ultimately, as both you and Sean have said, the immediate need to tackle that crisis is overrode everything, didn't it?
Absolutely. And I think you have to go back to that stage. I remember the night of polling day when we saw, you know, riots in the streets in Greece. The importance of establishing economic security for our own country was utmost in our minds. And Sean's absolutely right. You know, thinking of the market, what we wanted to show was we are strong together. We have a huge majority together. And we have the intent and the sense of purpose and solidarity to fix it. So that was the messaging of those first weeks in government.
It's very interesting, isn't it, Phil, listening to this, you know, the sort of division you identify between the sort of big society stuff, the George Osborne austerity stuff. Government handovers are always tricky, but they're made even trickier by crisis. And that's exactly where Keir Starmer finds himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important to try and extrapolate what we can from, you know, 2010. I mean, my report focuses possibly hubristically, more on the Conservatives' transition into power as a sort of single party, obviously accepting the complexities of the coalition. But no, I think it is very difficult. I mean, you know, we shall see what happens in the next few months. It's possibly unlikely there'll be anything on quite the sort of rupturing scale of the financial crisis. But we've had multiple crises over the course of the parliament, fairly obviously, you know, COVID, the energy crisis, Ukraine and so on. And those have clearly driven, you know, changes in the way that Labour are thinking. I mean, the change in Labour's policy prospectus from, you know, the beginning of this parliament to today is extraordinary.
And Kate, how do you go about, once you're in there, advising, getting on with the job, making sure the Prime Minister has the right people in place? Because, you know, your memoir is called The Gatekeeper. You know, you were in charge of who saw the Prime Minister, who couldn't. It must be very, very complicated in those crucial days and weeks when people are trying to shape the priorities of a new government, drive the agenda, take decisions that will ultimately reverberate through the 4 years, through the 5 years. That must be very tricky as well, making sure the Prime Minister is focused on the right things. And you had the added complication of, you know, a new coalition bedding in as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very important. The first few days in office really sets the tone, and the images of those days are sort of imbued in people's minds sort of forever. So the rose garden image, for example. But you're also forming a government. In our case, we're forming a coalition. And then because of the economic situation, of course, we had to have an emergency budget and a spending round, and prepare for all of that. And I think what Labour will be focusing on if they win the election, and you don't know that they will, I think economic security is the big watchword for them as well, because they will be mindful of the fact that, you know, markets might be a bit nervous about them coming into government. They've seen Liz Truss and they'll be spooked by that. So it'll be interesting to see if Labour do win, whether they'll be more steady as she goes, just trying to make sure no one is spooked, rather than making any sort of profound big announcements on day one or two.
And Sean, do you think in hindsight that the Liberal Democrats have prepared enough for the possibility of, you know, influencing the transition to government as they did in a very decisive way? And is it always worth a party that's coming from third place, or even now, you know, fourth or fifth place in the Commons, to put serious work into this?
I feel I'd be a bit hubristic if they're putting serious work into thinking what would happen if there was a formal coalition now, to be honest. What I would say the Liberal Democrats is they put a lot of thought into what would happen in a hung parliament and coalition negotiations. I am not sure we put as much thought as to then what would happen in government and what the levers of power were, or how the machinery of government worked. So I thought a lot about, from my perspective and my role, about how would he handle the comms, the media, and what the messaging be. I hadn't thought about the fact that I was then going to spend, you know, years, you know, sitting just down the corridor from Kate in number 10, and how that would work, and hated that. And it actually meant we took about a year in Deputy Prime Minister's office to get a functioning policy unit that had enough power in it to pull the right levers. And I think that's the thing, but it's like the Lib Dems, that Labour are clearly looking at now is Sue Gray, is you've got Keir Starmer and his missions, which are very complex, which are going to require a lot of centralised control, frankly, from a number 10 policy unit. Mm. You've got to think about where those levers are, how you pull them, how you beef up the cabinet office, how you're actually going to make this stuff work across and direct it centrally. I mean, we, the Liberal Democrats, I don't think have put enough thought into that. And I think a lot of administrations coming in probably don't put as much thought into that as they probably should. I felt that coalition overall, number 10 in the first few months, we probably gave the departments a little bit too much freedom. And all of a sudden, there were some things like we're going to privatise forests and whatnot that sort of came up. And all of a sudden, we went, no, hang on a second, we're pulling that power back to the centre. And I think that's what Labour need to think about now, is like how do they make sure that they are directing everything from the centre? Because ultimately, that's what needs to happen.
And Kate, final thought from you. Sean, I'll put this to you too, in a sentence or two. If you had your time again, if you had your first year in government again, if you had that transition again, what would you do differently?
So I think the thing that's the biggest change is you come in and you think, oh, I'm Deputy Chief of Staff, I've done that job before. But you don't realise that there's the small additional point about helping a Prime Minister run the country, and the sense of having to dock with officials as well as the coalition, which is quite complicated just in terms of people. So if I had my time again, I'm not sure what would prepare you for that, but I would have my eyes open to the fact that that would have been a challenge and that your team disperse and you need to make sure that you keep them tight-knit and really sort of strong and united.
And Sean, if you could do one thing differently?
Politically,
I'm sure the answer would be more sleep or less beer.
I think we spent too long actually worrying about did the country understand a coalition wasn't going to collapse. I think they got what a coalition was in about a week. Mm. I think as Liberal Democrats, we spent about 18 months sort of desperately trying to not look like there was any division. And actually, I think the public got that the Conservative Lib Dems are going to disagree a lot earlier than we were comfortable acknowledging that fact internally ourselves.
Something that seems to be important in any case is ensuring some degree of continuity from one government to another. Peter Mandelson spoke to Matt Chorley about just this on a recent episode of How to Win an Election.
I invented my own access talks, and I had 6 months before the election regular private meetings with my shadow as business secretary, Kenneth Clark. And so important was it, in my view, that there be sort of continuity from what I was doing on the sort of economic and industrial front and all the things that I was doing, the initiatives, the industrial activism, and all the other things I was doing. So important was the continuity from one government to another that I agreed to meet Ken Clark every month in my room in the House of Lords privately to take him through what I was doing and why, and try and enlist his support so that would, you know, go over into the election should they become, in the unlikely event of the Conservatives replacing us in government. And that I did very successfully. There's only one thing he demurred over. It doesn't matter what that was. It was actually to do with Royal Mail, but the rest he signed up to. But then, lo and behold...
Vince Cable
arrived, with whom I'd had no discussion, who initially did all sorts of rather stupid things.
Listening to that Filtin line and what you heard from Kate Fall and Sean Kemp just a moment ago, what stands out?
Well, one thing that stands out from what Kate and Sean were saying is the idea of power and how you think through how power works in advance. And I think, you know, you could see in, you know, the whole thing about privatising the forest. I mean, the reason that that happened is because they came in and didn't follow Lord Mandelson's advice on continuity, but winnowed down the policy unit very rapidly, and the delivery and strategy units in number 10 pretty much disappeared. And that meant...
Which is how a prime minister can drive through his agenda from the centre of government.
That was certainly the sort of Blairite idea. And I think there was a sort of sense that Blair and Brown had too much control and they perhaps veered towards having too little. On the other hand, what eventually emerged out of that, and particularly actually emerged out of the coalition, was the idea of the Quad, which was a sort of formal way to manage decisions about spending cuts as much as anything. But Labour are clearly talking about having a kind of inner cabinet of quite similar sort of consistency, although with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster rather than the Chief Secretary, I think. But no, I think having some sense of how power works, a theory of power, is absolutely crucial. And that goes alongside what I was saying at the beginning, which is the idea of having a clear sense of purpose. You know, being in government in many respects is a horrible way to spend your time. You need to know why you're there, and the public need to know why you're there, because that means that when you're faced with the invidious decisions that you will have to make 10 times every morning, it's clear why you're picking which bad option. And if you have a theory of power, you're then also able to drive that through. But that has two elements. It has the element internally, have a policy unit, have some sort of strong central control, but also have a sense of how power works in the country. Mm. Who is going to stand in your way? And not because they're evil, not because they're necessarily self-centred, because they believe particular things that clash with your beliefs. You need to identify who those people are and work out how you're going to, you know, do better.
And the difficulty for the Labour Party in all of this, despite their massive poll lead that we read about on the front page of this morning's Times, almost all of them who are going to be cabinet ministers or are likely to be cabinet ministers if the polls, like YouGov's big one in the Times today, or anything near right, with a couple of exceptions, and Keir Starmer is a particular case of this, they have very little experience or no experience of being ministers or cabinet ministers. I mean, Keir Starmer's run the CPS, so he's been a sort of a Whitehall permanent secretary before, but it must be even more difficult running the transition when you haven't been in cabinet before, and that was certainly the case with David Cameron as well.
Yeah, and they made a lot of effort, and as did people, you know, like Nick McPherson, who was running the Treasury, to try and sort of go back to the last time it had happened and try and learn lessons from before. So You know, Francis Maude took command of this for the Conservatives, who had been a minister before, in fact, before 1992, when he lost his seat. But there was a concerted effort to try to take junior ministers, people who sort of, who become junior ministers, through, you know, the sorts of things that they would need to know. But, I mean, you know, just I found just, you know, looking at this from the outside, just talking to advisors about the things that struck them, there is quite a lot, if you focus in on it and stop worrying about the election for 5 minutes, that you can really learn about just, you know, the complexity and unexpectedness of what you're going to face. I mean, for example, somebody said to me, an advisor said to me, former Conservative advisor said, you turning in opposition is one thing.
Mm.
You turning in government is a whole different proposition.
Well, Labour have been U-turning an awful lot over the past 3 years. And maybe that's a case of we get U-turns out of the way now, so we're not committed to these policies in government. Or if there are more to come, and when I speak to Labour people, they point to any number of policies saying, that's going to be a disaster, I think that's crazy, et cetera, et cetera. And that's on the Labour side. You know, things might be very difficult very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we saw with the, you know, the New Deal for Working People, Keir Starmer giving a one-word, you know, positive answer in Dudley the other day about whether or not Labour were going to, you know...
Ban zeros, just, contracts and all of that stuff.
Right, stick to it. And he just said yes, and it, because it will help economic growth as well as being the right thing to do. So, you know, there have been some signs in the other direction. But, no, clearly, if you U-turn in government, you know, you've got a whole bunch of civil servants who've been paid public money to do complex work. You will have to reverse all of that. You'll have to go to the Commons and make a sort of, you know, horrible sort of long sort of statement and answer questions and go through a generally very unpleasant experience. And it's worth being aware of that in advance. But it's also all sorts of more apparently boring things, you know, about, you know, the degree to which you're going to have to consult. I mean, somebody said to me that it's like going from working in a small business to working in the largest organisation in the country. You know, there are far more stakeholders, there's far more you need to do to make a change, there's far more people you need to consult and persuade. And I think what this can lead to is two risks. One is a sort of naivety that, you know, if you've never really run an organisation, suddenly you're running a government department, you know, there is a perhaps a tendency to think you should just do what your civil servants advise. And that can be useful, but can go too far. The contrary is a sort of Maoist response, which sort of says, this is the blob, this is the man, I need to, you know, bombard the headquarters and go round all of this. Again, that can quickly go too far. And there are examples of both of those things in 2010 that Labour could usefully learn from.
And another thing Labour can learn from, but can't necessarily plan for, is the unexpected, the known unknowns. If you think about David Cameron's government, they introduced a big programme of spending cuts, but then all of a sudden, its Chief Secretary to the Treasury, David Lords, is forced to resign over his parliamentary expenses. Steve Hilton, the man who was driving the big society agenda, the policy agenda, ends up leaving too a little while in. So there are lots of human issues, personnel issues that can derail a transition too.
One way of thinking about this is that when you go into government, you suddenly are subjected to immense pressure. And not just you personally, your personal life, you know, your personal foibles, your personal fragilities, but your ideological cohesion as a party, as an operation. Everything comes under enormous pressure. And as you say, for all sorts of different reasons, personal and political, people leave. And you saw that, you know, plenty of times in the past. You know, in 1970, a few weeks in, Heath loses his chancellor because he dies. You know, people have to resign over things that are revealed, all sorts.
Think about Peter Mandelson, the linchpin of Tony Blair's governments, right, of How to Win an Election, the podcast we can get wherever you listen to. He had to resign twice, despite being at the very centre of New Labour.
Right, and yet came back and was absolutely sort of central in the last years of Brown.
It's really, really, really interesting, this, Phil. I mean, if there's one piece of advice to conclude, if there's one thing Keir Starmer should absorb your report, or rather, maybe the person who reads it for Keir Starmer, if there's one line from that Keir Starmer should realise, the big lesson from 2010 he should learn, how would you sum it up?
Know what your overriding priority is. Decide it now. Persuade the public that that's your priority and embed it in a clear image of where that purpose is going to take you.
Which Cameron Osborne did very well. Well, Cameron Osborne did the first bit very well. We're going to cut the deficit. Maybe less well on the, and this is why we're going to do it.
Yeah, but also they hadn't decided that they were going to not do big society stuff because they were going to cut the deficit. So if you look at what happened at DWP, for example, they're trying to do both at the same time.
So it's almost as if you're saying, Keir Starmer's saying, I've got five missions. He really needs one.
The five missions should fundamentally boil down to one.
Is one. And I don't think we've heard that yet from Keir Starmer, that snappy, pricey of what he's all about, his one mission. But maybe when he reads your report, Phil, and learns the lessons from David Cameron, he might get there. Phil Tinline, thank you very much for joining us. Political historian, author of The Death of Consensus, and of a fascinating new report on what
lessons from 2010 and that transition for government can be applied to the present day. Well, that is all we have time for on today's edition of Politics Without the Boring Bits. But don't worry, I'll be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, you can like, share, subscribe and follow wherever you get your podcasts from.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.